I want to welcome you all and say good evening. I'm Connie Butler, the Chief Curator of Drawings here at MoMA. And thank you for coming to what is part of an ongoing series of conversations with contemporary artists. And each year at the beginning of the year, we sort of put our heads together with the education department here and sort of they come to us curators and ask so kind of who in the world, if you had a choice of contemporary artists that you could talk to, who would you like to actually be in conversation with? And Fiona came immediately to my mind. She's someone whose work I have admired for a long time and really wanted the opportunity, in fact, to hear her speak more about it and to talk to her myself. So with that, I will just give a brief but introduction to you of Fiona and a little bit about her career. Fiona Banner was born in Merseyside, England in 1966. She studied at Goldsmiths College in London, where she was associated with the celebrated young British artists movement of the early 1990s. She lives and works in London, from where she runs the Vanity Press. Much early work took the form of so-called workscapes or still films. And these were, my first introduction to her work, these kind of very riveting blow-by-blow accounts written in her own words of feature films, which took the form of books and then performative work as well. And the subjects ranged from war to pornography or sequences of current events. These pieces took the form of solid single blocks of text, often in the same shape and size as a cinema screen. Banner's current work encompasses sculpture, drawing, and installation, but text is still at the heart of her practice. She recently turned her attention to the idea of the classic art historical nude, observing a life model and transcribing the pose and form in a similar vein to her earlier transcription of films. Often using parts of military aircraft as the support for these descriptions, Banner juxtaposes the brutal and the sensual, performing an almost complete cycle of intimacy and alienation. Her work has been included in many international exhibitions in Europe, USA, and beyond, and she's represented in many important collections, including the collection here at MoMA, Philadelphia Museum, the Walker Art Gallery, Walker Art Center, in Minneapolis, and the Arts Council of England, as well as the Tate, of course, in London. She was also shortlisted for the Turner Prize in 2003. So with that, I will turn it over to Fiona, who's going to give a brief presentation, or hopefully not too brief presentation on her work, and then she'll join me down here in the front for conversation and discussion with you all. Thank you.
Thanks, Connie. Hi. This is my studio. As Connie said, I live and work in London. I just wanted to bring this photo with me because I took it the day before yesterday, just as I was about to leave the studio, and I just thought those trees are so beautiful. I wanted to bring them along, but I couldn't. So I bought the photo. The trees are planted in these huge planters that I made from some parts of military aircraft. I kind of collect parts of military planes, just happened. And in this case, what you can see is a chopped up drop tank from a Harrier jump jet. But you know, oddly enough, when I got it back to my studio, having procured this item through some dealers I know, it seemed so sort of absurd and looked like a kind of pantomime object, which didn't really lend itself to making a sculptural work as I understood it at the time. So I made these functional objects from this piece. It's also my studio. And this is also my studio. I do sometimes make artworks from parts of these airplanes. This is a polished wing from a Harrier jump jet. And in this case, I polished and polished and polished the item until it turned itself into a kind of mirror. And in doing so, became this sort of incredibly beautiful luxury object. But what I enjoy about this piece is that it at the same time as it working like a mirror, it also works as a kind of self-portrait, not of me, the artist, but of whoever's looking into it. So somehow you become embedded in the object through the process of looking at it. And given the function of this object in its other life as a fighter plane, that's interesting. This is another sculpture, in this case a wing from a Tornado airplane, which is again an aircraft that's currently in service. And in this case, the sculpture was made through a process of addition as opposed to erasure. And I painted the aircraft and then wrote a description of a nude onto the surface of it. And it becomes this very totemic object that somehow redolent of some form of worship. These are images of some very, very early pieces that I made while I was at college. And I was fascinated with the film Top Gun, and I made these Airfix models, these kit model planes. They were the first kit models that I made, and I attempted to reenact some of the incredibly ecstatic and beautiful flying scenes from the movie. Somehow, like all of the images that I was working with at that time, they became for me something disappointing and kind of redundant. But I was still fascinated by the film. It seemed like a very... though the film is almost a generic film, in a way, it's also an incredibly moving film. And I was fascinated by it, but also intrigued by my own fascination of this sort of almost generic film that at the same time seemed to say quite a lot about a political situation, though it was understood at the time entirely as a piece of entertainment. It was 1986 and the very end of the Cold War, and it seemed like an opportunity somehow to display these amazing aircraft that we hadn't seen in action for a while. This work led me to a very small text work. I think this the first work that I actually made using words, and this is called Top Gun. It's a description of the film Top Gun in its entirety. So if you like, it's a blow-by-blow account of the movie. What I liked about it was that I was able to describe absolutely everything that was happening in the film. So my frustrations of editing in a pictorial sense, as in where does the picture begin and end, but also in a linear sense in terms of incorporating time and a narrative dimension, those frustrations were to some extent solved with this way of working. But at the same time, the film has this incredibly heroic mainstream sort of narrative that then was defunct, and it it sort of became a picture of itself, if you like. These works became known as still films or wordscapes. This is another wordscape. It's called Apocalypse Now, and it's a description, again, in my own words, but in this case in my own hand, of the movie Apocalypse Now. I started to think about where my dilemma with images might have begun, and I realised that the first pictures that I really remember seeing were pictures of the Vietnam War, you know, through the telly, in the media as a young kid. And that led me to start to think about all sorts of complexities to do with how we interpret these major events that happen in the world. And I was incredibly seduced by this film. You know, it's an immensely beautiful film, but at the same time, it's full of repulsive pornographic imagery. And it kind of celebrates that imagery, you know, violent and complex imagery, but at the same time, you know, one becomes sort of tantalizingly repulsed by it. So this was a sort of exploration of that, and at the same time, I really enjoyed the literary references behind this film, because it came from the Conrad book, Heart of Darkness, that of course, you know, starts in London on the River Thames, and there were lots and lots of things about it that intrigued me. I then started looking at all the other Vietnam films a little bit more closely, because I'd been also really involved with them, and really really loved those films. So I started to think about what that might be about, and I wrote this book, The Nam, and The Nam is a 1,000-page paperback. It's a description of 6 well-known Vietnam films, in my own words, and the films are spliced together to make this big super movie of a book. In many ways, it was also an exploration of my own ignorance, because I realised that most of my understanding of Vietnam, the place, the historical zone, was informed by these movies, which I kind of realised was the same for a lot of people of my generation. So I'll read a bit. This comes from the film Apocalypse Now. Trees like palm trees in the distance fill up the foreground. They hardly move. Maybe the tops are swaying a bit. The sky behind is dull and pale blue. A wispy bit of cloud floats across the bottom. A slow rotating sound from somewhere else gets louder but still sounds distant as the heavy-looking grey copter moves across the sky in front of the trees. It moves slowly, but is gone quickly. Some yellow dust floats up in the wind and follows behind it, then fades into the green. There's some music, just strobing away, about to get to something. A bit more yellow dust smokes up, leaving a huge silence behind it. Then the music kicks in. Nothing happens but dust. Then, later on, the cow sliced up like a watermelon, like a slice has been taken out. There's white fat and fur beneath, and the skin flops, the head flops pathetically forward. The guts and shit and stomach and grass are just spilling out from its back. The guy at the back is just digging his machete into its guts, and it looks like it might get stuck. Then he hauls it out and goes in again, and the guy at the front keeps smashing down, kniving through the flesh. Then it's down on its side, motionless, other than for the hacking machetes. Willard lurches forward out of the shadows. He moves towards Kurtz like he's stalking his shadow, but Kurtz is down. He's lying on his bed. His big waxy face is splattered with blood. And later on, from Full Metal Jacket, the Kubrick film. Hartman's bang in the middle, his hat masks off the light behind and one row of men on either side. They're all mouths wide open, bawling out angelically, and their hands are gripping their crotches as they say, "This is for fun." They pull up and squeeze their balls. Formal, like an old dance, they get to the front and then peel off at the sides. Hartman swivels round and then heads back to the centre. "This is my rifle, this is my gun, this is for fighting, this is for fun." They echo and squeeze. Then everything gets pale and they fade back, walking forwards, outside, all wearing the khaki green uniforms and boots. Hartman stalks along to the left. The red flag is out front, flicking in the wind. And then at the end, this is from Platoon. "His face all smeared up with sweat and smoke. His face is visible, even closer up now. Some white light falls on from one side, making him look deathly pale, grey. The sky's this unnatural shade of orange gusting past from left to right. Then you can hear the vague sound of somebody crying. He gazes further down the hill, sees the devastation. The corpses are all wired up like the trees. Then a gaggle of men appear." Somebody said to me, when I finally published this book, that it was unreadable. And in response to that, I made this piece called Trance, which is a talking book version, 20-hour. I won't play it all now. And then... years later, I came back to those kit model planes, which was not... in fact, I'd forgotten that I ever made those works at college using these Airfix planes. But I started making more and eventually realised that I was working towards a full arsenal of fighter planes. That in the end, I made every kind of fighter plane currently in service anywhere in the world, from these very fragile, very involved little kit models. Actually working out which fighter planes were in service turned out to be a massive project in itself and subject to some speculation. I leading on from that, wanted to find, I kind of wanted to slot them into some kind of colloquial language, because I realised that some of the planes have these well-known nicknames, some less well-known, but I in the end found out the nicknames for every one of those planes, and they turned out all to be, or mostly to be called things from nature. So Thunderbolt, Warthog, Wasp, Fighting Falcon, Strike Eagle, Super Hornet, etc. And indeed, they did seem to, you know, say something. You know, those names sort of said something about how maybe, in spite of our fantasies about what nature is, perhaps this is nature itself. And when I hung all of these planes together, they kind of made this swarm of birds or something like that, which hung from the ceiling. And actually, one of the things that I liked about these models was the fragility of them. Though they represent these incredibly powerful, terrifying objects and very beautiful objects, they end up in this kit model form as very, very fragile objects. And I also started to muse, of course, over how weird it is that we give these kits to our children, and how strangely involving and obsessive they are to make. And so the whole language of the models became something really really interesting. I then made this book, which I published through my press, the Vanity Press. And the book was the culmination of a research project where I had researched what all of these planes were. That I made one in 2004 and then an updated version in 2006. So there's an image in this book of every fighter plane currently in service. And at the same time, there's no text in the book, so it's very... in a way, it's like the opposite of the NAM in that it's entirely images, but it still has this this idea about it, that it is a completely edited, unedited book, not one plane, but every plane. And all of the images come from newspapers, so there are the images as they come into our lives, not as they... Not as they exist in the war zone, but in that pared down domestic way that we end up seeing them in our world. And often those images turn out to be very picturesque and alluring. This is a series of drawings called The Bastard Word, and it's an alphabet drawn from those images. I was thinking of it as a kind of anti-alphabet in a way. These drawings, as I was making them, became kind of like weapons. Instead of a language that was about communication, a language that was about anti-communication, or what happens when there is no longer any communication. And yet they have... some of the intimacy and sort of sensuality that comes with drawing. Another alphabet. This is called Every Word Unmade. And again, an alphabet that doesn't actually make up words or sentences, the letters falling as they would in any Roman, in a normal Roman alphabet. So I was thinking of this, in this case, of this being redolent of so many possibilities, but somehow the words never forming. So maybe it could be every story in the world, but actually... that story has yet to be made or has become unmade. In this case, I made the neon pieces from myself. I was intrigued to find out what this quite now familiar stuff of neon is, and I realised that actually whenever I see it's professionally made and becomes kind of invisible. Perhaps that's what draws us to it so much. But I wanted to investigate it a bit further and see really what I could do with it and what its properties were. It takes a long time to learn how to bend neon, and I went to it as a complete... novice, and when I started working with the neon, I didn't practice. I just simply went straight into making this alphabet. So the letters themselves are the practice, and I wanted to keep that element of experimentation to it, and this idea that it was making a language for the first time. So it was incredibly unwieldy stuff to work with, this, and very sort of brittle, though the bending of the glass means that you have to make it hot, and it becomes very liquid as well, and then you blow into it. So somehow it had lots of the stuff of language in it, I found, you know, the liquidity of language, but also the brittleness of it. And the breath required as part of the process of making it as well. I had previously come to a kind of pause in my art making, and I think really what happened is that I became sort of separated from my language, and that made me think again about language and how we use it, how much it is part of us, how much it's an extension of us, our thoughts, communications, who we are as people, but also though we need it so much, it also is something that's very complicated, and we have it, we don't have it, it can do what we need, require it to do, and then it can't. And this, you know, is very much the stuff of it, I think. I wanted to explore this sense of disenfranchisement from my own project and try and find a way of proceeding through that exploration. I ended up making a series of sculptures of full stops, periods, and in blowing up these tiny little specks that really on the page is nothing more than a breath or a pause, I found that they had these terrific characteristics, and that some were round, some were square, some were little, some were huge. I blew them all up to the same proportion and discovered these anomalies. So to begin with, I made the works out of styrofoam, because styrofoam seemed sort of to suggest this virtuality, this thing that is only just an object, maybe one on from a word. And also it had some of the properties of transportation, packing, etc., that I started to think was also part of what these typefaces do. You know, they are couriers for meaning. So this is the period from a font called Avant-Garde. The piece is called Avant-Garde. If you like, a plinth waiting for meaning. Or this is Gil Sand's Condensed Bold, quite an odd one. This is New Century Schoolbook. Again, the titles became part of the work. I then wanted to make some sculptures that could go outside, and again, these sculptures came at a time when I didn't know how to proceed in my studio practice. So if you like, these works punctuate my practice, and it's for me interesting. For me, when I'm making these works, I'm kind of exploring a void as well. I'm exploring a block, if you like, or an emptiness. So to make these big, positive forms from that emptiness is sort of gives me a way of proceeding. These works are made from bronze, painted bronze, and they're out in a public space in London near the river. What I like about how they function as public works is that they're entirely approachable, and they do actually function as a kind of punctuation in space, in that people circumnavigate them. People often stand by them to have their photograph taken or to try to push them and play with them as if they are mobile objects, and they're in fact the opposite. But I think very few of the people that come across them are actually aware that they represent these punctuation marks. And yet they somehow function as punctuation nonetheless. So this is a kind of odd form as well. It's from a font called Slipstream. This is an elephant. This is an acetate disc, which is the first step that you go through if you're making a record, an LP. And prior to the LP being pressed in vinyl, your voice is recorded in this onto this plate, which is actually quite a fragile plate. And so if you like, it's kind of like the etching plate or the positive that then normally breeds hundreds and thousands of replicas. In this case, I only made one disc, and it's an unedited recording that I made of me describing a film called Arse Woman in Wonderland. Arse Woman in Wonderland is a porn film made by somebody called Tiffany Minx, who also acts in it. And I also made a ginormous poster, war-based piece by the same title, using the same text. The poster's kind of layered up on top of itself and has quite a kind of visceral quality to it when you see it. One of the aspects of the vinyl, the acetate disc that I made, is that every time you play it, it kind of records that playing, in that it gradually, very, very slowly erodes and has a limited ability to be played. So in a sense, it has this kind of live performative dimension to it. I then made a more intimate piece, if you like, called Porn War, which is a fantasy porn film spliced together with a fantasy war film. So it seamlessly, if you like, the account seamlessly goes from describing a war film to a porn film. I guess when I say fantasy, I probably mean from memory, though it's hard to be precise, but perhaps all the porn films that I've ever watched and all the war films that I've ever watched kind of came up into being this one sort of present memory. But it struck me that there are some very similar things going on in both of those, both the form of the classic war movie and the porn movie. From that, those works about porn films, I started making these very stripped back pieces that had lost all the narrative dimension and indeed the mediated dimension of the movie, and these were really just descriptions of nudes. The first one I made was of a porn actress who came to my studio, and I worked with her and did some made some portraits of her, and then that led me straight into this back into the life room, if you like, this sort of very well-known zone that probably all artists have visited at one point or other in their lives, but is actually most commonly identified with a sort of amateur art practice. And I started to muse on why we are so fascinated by life drawing, though these are unusual in that they are verbal accounts. They also quite directly refer to the history of life drawing. I mean, they cannot, but. And I suppose it just made me think that, you know, we are all paintings, all portraits, all life drawings and paintings are this attempt to create a mirror, you know, this thing that we can never actually do to see ourselves. I made some sculptural works also of these life drawings, and they were many of them are freestanding, so they have a sort of front and a back, and took on a kind of performative stance in that respect. But I also liked thinking about the back of a work of art, the thing that we so rarely see in the case of a picture, and what that might mean. So obviously it has some reference to the back of the body, but also the sort of secret part of a work, or I was thinking about this idea of a work of art itself having a life and looking back at us and those sorts of things. So I then took that idea of performance a bit further, and actually did a series of life drawing performances that I called performance nudes. And I started off doing them not in an art context, but in a literary context, because I was asked to take part in some literary festivals in Britain. And so I made some life drawings live, which involved the model getting onto the stage and me, all the paraphernalia of me creating a picture of her or him in that context. So it was really sort of extending this cycle of voyeurism, and they were in one way a sort of joke that became something serious. And there was something very humorous about performing these life drawings, both for me and the model, who actually subsequently became quite a good friend. But this piece we're looking at here is, these pictures are of a performance that is actually a film and has a slightly odd life as a film, in that, again, it's a one-off film. So it doesn't predict any copies. It's the filming of this performance, and indeed there was nobody present at the performance except me and the camera. The duration of the performance is the same duration of a the media, the tape that I was filming onto, which is approximately 50 minutes. So it's one unedited take. I then did a performance with the actress Samantha Morton, and she came to my studio and posed for me naked. I made a description of her, which she performed the next night at the Whitechapel Gallery in London. And we agreed that she wouldn't read the text that I'd used to describe her prior to the performance. So the performance became this kind of undressing for her, but also this process of unacting, if you like. And this was what resulted.
Nails shall pink. Her tits spill out from behind her massive hands. The shadow strikes her side. Her profile's electric. Arse, moon white. both feet pacing forward, foreshortened, kind of classical. Thin papery arches exposed, legs strong, kicked back, veins showing through the skin like fluorescent roots. I like that. Her face is tilted, dark in its own shadow, lips parted as if to speak. Glimmer of a bone, white tooth. One hand absently stroking the back of her neck like it's somebody else's funny. A tuft of dusty hair on her ochre forehead. And then she looks up, light making two mirrors in her black eyes. Smiling, not smiling, smiling. Cheek creased on one side. She twists her whole body, waiting to find a pose. For a moment, her hands clasp her tunic face, then they rest on her hips. Scuffed elbows pointed out to the side. Her tits fall out onto her chest, warm against the deadpan wall. Nipples erect, lip pink. Breathing and then blinking shadow. Head thrown back, eyes like jewels, a comma above each. Her waist curves in, then out. Wide hips stretching her baby foot stomach. Muscles taut over haunches. Magnolia hips nudging the dark around her skin, the colour of bruised peach. Knees a knot of shadow. Knees that have been held on. Ribs making zebra shadows. Hollow grey where her diaphragm bellows. A tapering crack of blue-black shadow between her thighs. An arrow to her cunt. Cubes, a zillion lines twisting to a soft quiff. A crazy scribble of shade collecting at the seam of her thigh and growing onto her stomach. All shadows pouring into her navel, darkest full stop. Right in her middle, the beginning and the end.
One of the strange things about that film is that I actually agreed with Samantha that we wouldn't film the performance. It seemed contrary to the liveness of the events somehow. And a few months afterwards, somebody got in touch with me and said that they had this footage of the performance. It was the guy that had been asked to record another performance that Ed Rocher was doing after me on that same night. And he recorded Samantha talking because he was just warming up his camera, etc. So I did end up with some footage of the event, but it was had this odd feeling about it, which somehow makes, you know, betrays it as being found footage, which it was. So in an odd way, it gave me something that did reflect the spontaneity of unrehearsed dimension of the event.
Thank you. That was really riveting, I think, really interesting. It actually occurred to me that to ask you a question first that I didn't at all occur to me kind of in preparing thoughts for today, but just thinking a little retrospectively, I wonder if you, I was thinking about the generation of artists that you came up with, and because there was so much attention around this young British artist thing, mm-hmm. and now I think we all, you know, the way those other careers have developed and so on. It seems to me that your work among those peers is quite conceptual and sort of unique in its use of language and this sort of tension between language and abstraction and then also imagery, which comes in and out. But I wonder if you could, I don't know, think about or just say something thinking back on kind of that moment and how your work was situated in relationship to that of your peers.
Well, it always surprises me when people say that I was part of the young British artist movement, because I never really felt that I was. My work's always somehow challenged the idea of an art object or an image in the sort of dynamic, sensational way that's associated with the YBA scene. But then at the same time, I was working alongside a lot of people that were very much part of that. So, you know, I always felt I was doing something a little bit different, and I still do. I suppose it's it always surprises me as an association.
So talk a little bit about, I mean, you kind of began to allude to it, but talk a little bit about how you actually did kind of begin to use language as a, you know, as a material and actually the substance and image in the work.
Well, I struggled for a long time with trying to make paintings, you know, before college, at college, and then I kind of stopped making work. I always have written a lot. It never occurred to me that might become part of my art practice. But I did start to write quite a lot about the problems of the image. What was I looking at? And then I started to try and I think then actually I did start describing images and trying to work out what was so seductive about some of these images that I got really really involved in. You know, for instance, the movie Top Gun. Why was that so alluring and yet so complicated at the same time? So it was a way of exploring, and then I did end up describing the image completely. It occurred to me that might be a way of building up a picture that was a picture, but also obviously a picture that described itself. So it also gave me a way of being able to represent a narrative, a duration of time. And that later in the nude pieces became a very, though different from, though I used language differently in those pieces, it became a way of being able to track the changes in the mood of what's going on, being able to, you know, move around the model, being able to record an engagement with the model, separation from the model, so somehow to describe that difference, that distance between the, you know, subject, object, me, and what I was looking at.
Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about the, like with the film works, how you actually, I mean, what that process is. I mean, I sort of imagine that you work yourself into some kind of state where you could just ramble on and or do you make notes and then put together the narrative, or how does that actually work? I've always been curious.
All the movies that I've ended up making works from, I've been very involved with anyway, so they're not films that have sort of come to me necessarily through my work. They're films that I've been intrigued by and in each case, I think the core of that intrigue is that they function way beyond how I originally thought they were going to function. So, you know, those Vietnam films, you know, they are these active elements of ideological conquest, but we go to them for entertainment. So it was a sort of seductive power of those movies that drew me to them. So when I came, for instance, to make the piece Apocalypse Now, it was a natural exploration of that seduction, I suppose. And I set out to begin with to make this very impartial, if you like, this very complete description of the movie, and genuinely describe absolutely everything that happened in the film. But of course, you notice what you notice, and the subjectivity of my observation comes through, though that's something that, oddly enough, was quite surprising to me years later when I reread the description of that film. You know, clearly, one is in love with Willard. Everybody is. So there's also a huge amount of time given to descriptions of, you know, the blue light and the sweat on his face or his physique, whereas, you know, other things are not so prioritized. So it's an involve just an extension of that involvement with the film, I suppose, but also trying to get to what is so odd about it, what is so, you know, what makes it so influential that we actually could be insane enough to believe it. Mm-hmm. So,
you mentioned earlier the sort of having a difficult relationship with performance and how performance has come into the work, and there is this, I think, really interesting progression from the sort of performative aspect of the film pieces and the earlier work, and then how the performance is actually now, of course, actualized with the model and your own image now actually as part of it too. Can you talk a little bit about how that, what that difficulty has been, and how it functions for you?
Well, the performances are incredibly awkward.
Because of the presence of the model and your...
Well, they're awkward for me, they're awkward for the model, they're incredibly awkward for the audience. And part of that awkwardness is this sort of exposed layers of voyeurism. So me describing the model, this sort of objectifying of this person standing there, not this form, but this person standing there, and awkwardness of people observing me making an artwork, the sort of expose of that, the sort of strange effect that the demythologization of the art piece has on everybody, but at the same time, there's something sort of oddly humorous about it. You know, it's so sort of deadpan, but in a way, you know, there's always this knowing rapport between me and the model. It's kind of on the edge of being a big fat joke, but mm-hmm. it ends up in this very taut, serious moment. Mm-hmm. But the awkwardness of it is kind of what's interesting about it, really.
It seems like it's a similar awkwardness, maybe, and humor that functions in the film works as well, too, because, I mean, it's just a sort of ridiculous project at some level, the absurdity and the massiveness of, yeah. you know, of what it
yeah.
is. And yet it's deadly serious, and you're extremely engaged. And
yeah, yeah.
All of that.
And I think also the flattening out of the narrative, the flattening out of the duration as well. But mm-hmm. with the film pieces, mm-hmm. that often they are these immensely heroic mm-hmm. narratives that you know, that narrative dimension becomes defunct and replaced with a different kind of narrative, you know, one that doesn't begin and doesn't end and doesn't have that climactic curve to it at all. So there's a very strange deadpan dimension to that. But I suppose different things about the films are revealed through writing it. And, you know, people recognize different moments or become drawn into the text in a very, oddly, in a very pictorial way because people read them, the viewer reads them as an image. It's an odd way of coming to writing, but I think it's, or coming to reading, but I think it reveals something, you know, strange about how we how we read and how we take these big stories in.
I'm really interested in this idea of the anti-heroic, and in fact, I was going to ask you a question about, you know, where you see the politics situated in the work, or how, you know, which I think is there, or do you see the work as post-feminist or something, but instead, maybe a more productive way to talk about it is to talk about this sort of anti-heroics of and this sort of almost de-skilling, kind of doing things badly or roughly, as you talked about with the neon. Excuse me. But I think also even the choice to work so much with drawing is an interesting one, and a kind of almost anti-heroic choice in certain, in the body of work. And I wonder, maybe you can talk about that a bit.
Yeah, it's to respond to the first half of your question. It is hard for me to talk about my work in terms of politics, and I think a lot of the impetus, a lot of the motivation for me in starting to work in this textual way was to avoid some of the issues that the image always throws up. So some of the art historical and, well, generally historical references that I would be forced to deal with directly if I was making pictorial portraits of the female nude can be not ignored, but worked around through working with text. And I'm kind of loath to use the word politics because it kind of leads one into issues.
Yeah.
And then when you're in the land of issues, you're talking in quite a didactic way, I feel. And conceptually, art's a very fragile thing. And issues are much more sort of black and white. And I don't feel that the two apply very... I don't feel that's a good way of interpreting the work or thinking about it. So, you know... I suppose a lot of the energy that goes into my work is about trying to work with these very these things that for me are very provocative, but without getting stuck in the issue-based sort of references. To respond to your question about doing things in a sort of amateurish or in a very direct kind of way. I suppose I feel that, you know, for instance, with the neon work, that it was, you know, one, I wanted to make a drawing out of neon. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to ask somebody to make a drawing for me out of neon. I wanted to explore what it would be like grappling with this new kind of language for the first time. And in doing so, I think it did kind of reveal something of itself. You know, when you look at that, those neon letters, they're incredibly sort of fragile and odd, and unwieldy in a way. And they reveal some of the, you know, what I feel are the complexities of language, of not being able to always to find it, maybe not always being able to get your mouth around the words or get the words to to work in the way that you want to. So it sort of had this, ended up with this sort of strange feeling of like being really drunk and not being able to quite formulate meaning anymore. And so if somebody had made that piece for me, it wouldn't have revealed or, you know, had those qualities. I think it's good to use materials in a way that where it's enough. You're using the you're manipulating the medium enough to get it to do what you need it to do, but it's not about the virtuosity of having accomplished the medium. Mm-hmm. It's much more of an experiment with the medium.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the choice to really also work with drawing and not, I mean, is a and with paper is to, in some way, continue with that sort of sense of the fragile or the almost impoverished or.
Yes, I mean, I wouldn't actually say necessarily fragile or impoverished, but I would say direct.
Yeah.
You know, we all of us can draw. Mm-hmm. We may not think we can, but we can.
It's not true, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, even in the simplest sense, we can. And somehow drawing is, you know, it's a very... I wouldn't even digress into why, but it's a very good extension of a recurrent thought. It's a very good way of exploring a kind of thought that comes back on you and won't go away. And at the same time, it's ludicrously sort of primitive. But that's kind of that's often what's great about it. So I just think that, you know, with the drawings of parts of planes, etc., those you know, the fragility of those drawings is, you know, oddly important.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, So drawing never quite goes away. You know, even the verbal pieces, they do really feel like drawings. Mm-hmm. And you know, the piece that I a large collection of fighter plane drawings that I showed in New York a couple of mm-hmm. years ago. I started that drawing in 1985 and shelved the first few drawings, you know, the first drawings I made of fighter planes, kind of put them away. You know, they seemed ridiculous and very disappointing to me. But somehow, you know, I did put them away, not throw them away. And years later, they came out, and other drawings joined them. And, you know, in the end, there were 200 drawings of all these fighter planes. And it wasn't that I thought they built up. They became this incredibly successful drawing. It wasn't about that. Mm-hmm. I just felt that they revealed something, and that had happened through something quite organic and odd, really. That they sort of the drawings happened. You know, I didn't entirely intend to make all those drawings over the years, but they happened as an extension of something that wouldn't go away.
And has the work with the fighter planes now finished after that kind of accumulation?
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah.
Those drawings have finished.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Maybe we should, open it up to the audience.
We have microphones, so hold on one second.
I'm really intrigued with the neon alphabet, especially the aspect of it being words that are kind of waiting to be born and the fertility of that piece as a collection of those tools. And I'm very interested in the concept of text being a toolbox of the mind, and you said that language kind of becomes an extension of our thinking. So can you summarize your own thoughts about how text as a construct empowers your creativity or confines you to assimilate because it's already preformed, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I noticed that somehow when I'm looking at something extraordinary, I turn that into work. I interpret that through words in my head. I don't know entirely if everybody does that or not. So the, you know, extension of extraordinariness or some perhaps slightly unfathomable scenario is that I try to describe it to myself. I try, maybe that's the way that I can, that, you know, that one can hold it. I don't know. So that translation has already started happening. And of course, I, you know, I think we are all, you know, I think there's this sort of wonderful idea that maybe we can experience things without words, that words don't come into it. You know, sex, no, you know, it's not about words. You know, in the, in porn films, there's no, very rarely any script. So there's these sort of this idea of these sort of very powerful sort of thought, you know, deep experiences. They might not require, might be pre-language or post-language or other than language. But somehow, for me, you know, words always come into it. So I don't know. Your question is sort of chicken and egg.
Right.
Yeah. So I mean, who knows? There's been reams and reams of words written on this very this very subject, and we will never know.
That answers both the chicken and the egg question, because first it's like, you know, when you see something extraordinary, the words start coming.
Yeah.
They're the toolbox, but then there's also these pre- and post-language feelings that kind of provide this angst.
Yeah.
Cool, I think.
But also, you know, the full stop, the punctuation pieces are kind of about that as well, an attempt to celebrate abstraction, to celebrate this idea of an artwork without words, that we don't circumnavigate in words, or that we don't, doesn't require words. In fact, it's the opposite of a language. It's something abstract, but, you know.
Yes.
I was just wondering, when you did the writing of
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse. It was your own words, your own interpretation,
yeah.
Not the written word. Have you ever done anything like today? I'm reading Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin, and on one of the pages it talks about Abraham Lincoln going to Gettysburg, and then it writes down the Gettysburg Address. Would you ever do something like with other words, that because that address has such a meaning for me as an artist, would you take something like that or Hamlet's soliloquy and transpose that onto into an interpretive art?
Well, so we're kind of talking about words as a ready-made, as something that that you find and represent. I kind of feel like I do that anyway, because, you know, in the film pieces, there's a lot of dialogue, there's sort of, somehow it always comes down to a process of interpretation, though, doesn't it? Because there's always a voice behind those words, there's always a type on the page, there's always the nature of that page, and I guess that's what sets this some of this work aside from what we would consider a literary endeavor, because the book sort of on the whole denies its own objectness. It's about the fantasy between the pages, the fantasy within the narrative, not the fact of itself, not the fact of the book. So I guess it would never quite work like that for me, because there would always be a, you know, I would always betray myself through the way that I presented that text, or through somehow the texture of the voice behind it would be something a bit different from what you're talking about, I think.
I was curious about your inclusion in this literary festival where you did the performance. Did that, was that invitation because of a kind of, because you're an artist who uses text, or was it and your response was then to make the performance, or was it a sort of misunderstanding of what your work is, do you think? And that was your response, or?
Well, I know quite a lot of writers, I think they asked me because I work with words, but how I was going to deal with the invitation was unclear. And in fact, what you do have endlessly at literary festivals is people reading from their works and then maybe talking about it a bit. So it was in some ways the fact of participating in that event that led me into the making the performances, because I thought it would be funny to do something so sort of absurdly literal in that context, because it is sort of what writers do. You know, they do imagine a situation and describe it. I mean, I was laying it all very bare and stripping back the narrative, you know, stripping off the clothes of the whole scenario, but you know, they were a bit. Most of the writers that were there, or the literary folk, were kind of got really involved in it, but actually were a little bit upset by it because it was so sort of so immensely direct. It was almost like, you know, I don't know. And it also had this very strong aspect of duration to it. You know, there's the duration of the performances, you know, either when the model can't hold the pose and falls over or, you know, walks off, or when I reach the bottom of the page, you know, the canvas or whatever. So it had lots of very things that were very resonant for writers in it, that performance. But I was kind of on one level a bit of a ruse, but at the same time it was quite a big thing for me to take this practice that is actually a very private kind of thing, you know, this making of the artwork that normally would only ever take place in my studio, out of the studio and expose all of that. But in it, actually, some of this sort of dilemma that we all have about the process of objectification, the intention of subjectification, where all of that lies, subject, object, it kind of came together in one sort of present tense at those performances.
It makes me think, which I hadn't thought before, that one of the things that those works do is I think they remake the experience of being the viewer into a private one. And, you know, I think to come upon one of those works in a very, you know, here at the museum, for example, when there are just so many people around and it's, you know, the situation of kind of how long you spend in front of something, how private or public it is, they sort of insist on it being a very self-consciously private private act again.
Yeah, I think that's true, you know, however, you know, despite yourself, you do get drawn into this intimacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the works are more intimate than others.
Yeah.
Perhaps it depends on the mood of the model, the relationship between us, et cetera, et cetera. But that space between me and the model then translates as a space between, into the space between the artwork and the viewer. And that's kind of the whole context of the making of the pieces, really, that is some sort of understanding of that. I think both for the model and and for me. Mm-hmm.
Are there other questions?
I was curious about the significance of color in your work. There's a lot of monochromatic work, and then when you use a color, it's a very definite color. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, it is and it isn't a definite color. I really consider myself to be somebody that doesn't understand color. I mean, like all of us, I respond to it emotionally, but I do not, as an artist, really understand how it functions. And it isn't really my game, but I describe a lot of color in the work and am pushed to extremes sometimes in the language that I use through the need or desire to describe a color or a change in color or, you know. But when I use color in the work, it's actually it's almost like not color. So the book here, the NAM, you know, this was a very big thing for me to make this color cover. But, you know, this is a Pantone warm red, and this is a Pantone perfect blue. The text inside is actually Helvetica. So there's a sense of reducing color to its sort of something so obvious that maybe that those colors here are sort of so obvious that they aren't really colors anymore. Or the in certain works I've used this sort of hazard red that is, you know, I've used the red because it somehow reflects something about the urgency of the work, that I'm seeing the work almost as a sign, so it kind of compresses the text into a very visual moment. And with the fluorescent text that I used on the Ask Woman print, that sort of fluorescent, I don't know, is that a color? Maybe, but it was sort of, I used that because I wanted you to be drawn into the piece, but also pushed away from it. So it becomes it's a very physical piece to look at, to be part of. And the text within the piece is also very physical, and it's something that you're drawn into and actually slightly embarrassed by or have an odd sort of relationship with, I think, as the viewer, because it's both very intimate in that it's sort of describing this pornographic activity, and yet there you are in a public space sort of unraveling this, you know, having this sort of porno narrative unravel them in front of you. So there's a sort of a drawing in and a repelling, and that's kind of how I feel about that film as well, is that, you know, despite myself, I'm very seduced by it. You know, I'm turned on by it, but at the same time, I'm kind of repulsed by it, and I'm a little bit worried about my, you know, political, you know, whatever. It's about these things, but it's also about color is that's the kind of way that I see color. But also, of course, in writing, color is nearly always black and white, and that seems to be, to me, a very important thing about a book, is that it's so very much the opposite of what it's describing. It's such a sort of abstract, physically abstract language that it's, you know, in terms of what it's attempting to do and the extraordinariness that often language tries to convey. So color, yeah, it's there and it isn't there.
Hey, Bjorn, I was interested in what you said about being on the edge of a big fat joke, and and just wondering whether that's something you find really helpful to kind of get you to a place, or to explore a place that and for you and the viewer.
Yeah. I think it is. I think with the full stop pieces, you know, they actually came out of, I mean, personally, quite a dark experience. You know, it's horrible if you're a writer or an artist or anybody in any situation, and you don't know where to go, where to take the thing. You know, your very language, your very freedom, suddenly is sort of gone. You know, I can't work anymore. So, but there's a kind of joke to then turning that into something so sort of physically manifest, something so sort of cartoonish, if you like. And yeah, that helps, I think, to have that sort of as a motivator, as a sort of way of moving meaning along, you know, of creating, you know, being able to share meaning. I mean, it's all, you know, on one level, it's also deadly serious. It's kind of ridiculous to me. But at the same time, you've got to have that big sort of laugh bubble above your head and say, I mean, for God's sake, really, let's just move this on. And so yes, humor's, I mean, I don't even know if humor is the right word, but that elliptical dimension that it's absurd and yet it's serious is important to how I can proceed.
Because there's always a tension in a successful work of art.
Yeah, yeah, yes.
And that seems to be one that you play with a lot.
So. Yeah, I mean, I've made some really humorless works, but I don't think they're very good. They're the ones that, you know, get recycled.
Other questions? Yep.
I was just wondering what provoked you to use porno films as part of your work, like something so private, or what came first? Did that come first, or did you think how you were describing to him before, you know, something that you rarely use words, where did that come from?
Well, in some ways, you know, there are several answers to that question, but in some ways it came out of the experiment of writing the NAM. And I kind of realized at the end of that it's weird, you know, there are hardly, everybody's always got clothes on, and it's nearly always men. So I thought, well, let's turn that inside out. You know, it's nearly all women, no clothes. So it's a way of sort of proceeding with language and kind of, you know, keeping that, you know, moving, keeping that, you know, language as a medium, if you like, you know, taught and challenging it. But at the same time, I did, a lot of the films that I've been looking at and working from, I did think were pornographic. You know, it's not maybe usual to talk about the film Hamburger Hill as a porn film, but I did find a lot of those images, mm-hmm. the imagery in those films, incredibly pornographic and incredibly hard to deal with. I mean, particularly the fact that I was titillated by some of those very sort of violent, very invasive images. And, you know, they're all about penetration, those films, anyway, you know. Penetration by bullet, penetration by, you know. So it's just, there were some formal, you know, formal things like that going on, and at the same time, a sort of exploration of this idea of pornography. What is pornography? You know, it's material that is very, you know, uncomfortable, but is there.
I was wondering in the new drawings if there are many of them just have text from margin to margin, but there are some which to me really evoke the shape of the body. And I was wondering if that was a conscious decision on your part or it was just sort of the randomness of the line. I mean, I look at some of them, and there's very much the small of the back or the underarm as it hits the torso. And were those conscious decisions or just sort of randomness of lines?
Well, you know, I started to realize that working from a model in real time, in real space, is very different from working with, you know, from a movie, which is framed, which has a duration, which has been edited, you know, has a prescribed time and prescribed form. So I had a problem, you know, it didn't... The contained image of, you know, the framed image of a nude didn't seem quite right. You know, it didn't really hold the moment for me. So that's when I started working directly on the wall and making these wall drawings of nudes. Often they're in the corner or something like that, but you know, they are ultimately unframed, I guess, or the nudes that stand, that are framed but stand in space, they're also kind of unframed because the language leaks out onto the back. The title is on the back, indeed, which is the back, which is the front at the end of the day. So, yeah, I think there's a knowing. I don't know how conscious it was, but there's certainly a knowing unframing going on in those works that feels very different from the movie works. And the sense of duration and time is different in the nude works as well.
Maybe we'll have one last question, if there is one. If not, Fiona, thank you very much.
Oh, it's wonderful. Thank you. Thanks, Connie.